Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. Leaders in all organizations, large and small, are faced with the challenging process of developing a comprehensive delivery of care strategy that integrates the different modalities of a digital engagement. On this show, we explore the challenges as well as how care delivery is extended beyond the classic bricks and mortar health institutions to a digital health home. You can learn more about this show by visiting healthcarenowradio.com. And be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and the hashtag The Virtual Shift. On the show today, we have Tom Leary, Senior Vice President of Government Relations at HIMSS. In his role, Leary leads the organization's digital health policy development work and strategic engagements with government and membership. Leary also serves as the Executive Director of the HIMSS Foundation. Tom, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for including me, Tom. Looking forward to it today.
Awesome. Should be a very good conversation. You're obviously very much involved in some of the legislative actions that are taking place in Washington. We seem to have solid bipartisan support, which is a great thing for this country. I believe that there's three pieces of legislation. If you could tell us a little bit more about those acts, the Protecting Access to Post-COVID-19 Telehealth Act, the Telehealth Modernization Act, Connect for Health Act.
Absolutely. At the heart of all of that is digital healthcare for all Americans. You know, and at HIMSS and our team members at the Personal Connected Health Alliance, you know, HIMSS has been very much involved in the digital health space since really when we brought on the mHealth Summit several years ago, and we've been involved in the evolution of legislation around digital healthcare. What those three acts really embody is what can be the making more permanent what can be with respect to digital healthcare. Prior to the pandemic, digital healthcare, particularly telehealth, was very much limited by location and provider type, you know, as far as Medicare reimbursement. So what we saw and what the country had to do, and really what the globe, what is healthcare organizations across the globe have really had to do is think again and think creatively, think innovatively about how to utilize telehealth in a way that can improve access to care in a safe environment so that a patient isn't going into the doctor's office unnecessarily and being exposed to the virus. What we've learned from that is the innovative piece of there are lots of different provider types and lots of different care settings can promote and support telehealth services. So the idea of these pieces of legislation is to, one, make permanent some of the activities around the originating site, whether it's the patient is at home or do they have to be at a healthcare facility, and the provider types that have access to use of telehealth. We don't want to go backward to pre-pandemic approach to then get to where we are before we go forward and really utilize the innovation. So it's talking about the provider types, the originating sites for care. And then of course, the third piece is of course, reimbursement. And the debate will be in a lot of ways for this year. And I'm sure we'll touch on, you know, some of the value-based care issues throughout this conversation is should an audio only encounter be reimbursed the same as an audio and video? Those types of things will be a part of some of the debate this spring and summer.
Interesting. So when you talk about telehealth and audio and video, does the definition of telehealth go far enough in the context of the home and myself being the patient? I've always said, you know, I've always used the example actually of the average Medicare patient with five chronic conditions sees nine different doctors in a given year. They only spend 15 hours in front of their doctor, all those doctors. The question is, what happens in the other 8,745 hours? That's really where the path to wellness is. Right. Because it requires me to change my behaviors and be compliant and persistent with my care plan. So does telehealth certainly increases access to some extent, But does the idea of just using audio and video go far enough in context of the true medical home of that patient?
No, it's really the you've touched on a perfect issue of, you know, it's really the broader digital health, why we talk about digital health, not just telehealth, but the full suite of technologies that might be available to an individual and their caretaker. Their caretaker, caregiver, and their providers. So if you have remote patient monitoring, for example, a diabetic maybe would be able to keep track of their sugar levels and be able to transmit into a provider setting. And what we've seen during the pandemic is that the limiting the number of required encounters hasn't seen a decrease in the overall care or the overall wellness of the individual. So prior to the pandemic, it was a minimum of 16 encounters in order to for a provider to be reimbursed. Mm-hmm. During the pandemic, it was 2 encounters, but digitally based, right? Now it's during the pandemic, it's 2 encounters. And what they're talking about is going back to that 16 encounters in order to be reimbursed. And what technology will helps with, and what remote patient monitoring really does, is it puts a minimum number and a maximum number for the patient's whatever's being tracked. And if the patient goes below X or above Y, providers are alerted, and then they interact with the individual to find out what's going on. They don't have to do a check-in every day or every other day.
Does the idea of continued drive to reimburse on encounter counts, if you will, inhibit the path to value-based care? The point there being is, if I'm a physician or a health system charged with caring for a person with diabetes, does it matter the number of encounters that I have? Certainly, the more encounters, the more resources. However, if I want to do a daily touch with someone that is chronically ill with diabetes, you know, as opposed to saying, "Hey, if I don't get paid, I'm not going to do it," right? So that defeats the purpose of the path to wellness. So, educate me and the audience on sure. the balance of that.
What we've seen from our members, you know, is even prior to the pandemic, a lot of our members were putting in telehealth services and digital health services because they saw the benefit of interacting with the patient and empowering the patient to be actively engaged in their healthcare. So the number of times isn't necessarily as important as making sure that you're providing the tools to both the patient at home, you know, and the provider to be able to keep better track of where the individual is, so they stay within those parameters, you know, the set parameters. And that really, being able to, you know, whether it's some of the tools that we've seen, canes that have, RFID tags in them, or, you know, certain types of chairs that have, you know, it's pressure sensors, and you get information if the person's sitting too long, you know, but certain types of conditions you want the individual to be up and about more, you know, being able to get that remote information so that a nurse or you know, the clinician, you know, any of the clinicians can call and say, "Hey, notice that you're, you know, a little more sedentary today. What's happening?" And that helps with the wellness. One, someone's paying attention. So it's kind of like that Hawthorne effect of someone's paying attention, and I should be paying it better attention to myself as well. So that wellness issue.
Yeah, I agree. So before I get too far down the road with value, let me step back on the legislative front. I'm just curious, one of the big issues that helped alleviate a lot of the pressure in health systems was whether a physician in one state could care for a patient in another state. In the legislative acts that are currently in play, do you see that compact, if you will, extending across all 50 states, or that model extending beyond the emergency?
Specific to the current pieces of legislation, we have to do a little bit deeper dive, but the idea of the provider compacts that have been endorsed by, I think, over 25 states at this point from the physician side, and similar number of, you know, the nursing associations have endorsed a compact that allows for providers from other states to treat patients, particularly given the fact that, you know, we have a provider shortage. There's been an ongoing conversation around, you know, whether it's doctors or nurses or other skilled clinicians. There's a shortage. If we can augment it through digital healthcare, there's been widespread support for that. So that's the type of thing that we would anticipate continuing to grow, and, you know, that Congress, we would expect Congress to really take the next leap forward with more support from the many groups that are they're speaking out on its behalf.
I think you just nailed the problem, frankly. And the problem is pre-COVID, the challenge that we were dealing with is our path to value. And the path to value was being somewhat distorted, in my opinion, because we had the macro trends where we had a growing population, we had a population that was aging, and the average age of the population was older, and then they were developing more and more chronic conditions as they aged. So we had the older, aging, sicker population. On the flip side, we had less doctors and nurses. So the question is, how do you provide care to an older, aging, sicker population with less doctors and nurses? Hence, the idea was to leverage telehealth.
Right.
But COVID brought the telehealth from a nice to have service to a must have service. So, and I think that we're after post COVID, I think we're now on this shift to have a better set of tools in order to serve that population. What are your thoughts on that?
And that's really the big, one of the big questions that we'll be facing the healthcare system is, you know, we've been hearing from our members for several months, you know, that, hey, we've made the investment in digital healthcare, and we need to make sure that we still have that tool available to us and to the full suite of providers that have been leveraging it. You know, you have a pharmacist, for example, who has been who might be involved in telehealth during the pandemic, and suddenly the pandemic's over. They're no longer qualified to utilize the technology. They should have been qualified to utilize the technology to begin with. A lot of the challenge in the past was the cost. And yeah, the Congressional Budget Office often pointing to the fact that there wasn't enough data on how Medicare patients would use the technology and what the cost savings, cost avoidance, or cost impact would be on the Medicare system. You know, just in the first few months of the pandemic, we saw, you know, I think it was a 3 or 4-fold increase in telehealth usage by the Medicare population, which in turn provides the data that should be able to answer the questions that the Congressional Budget Office has had about the impact on the Medicare program. Increasing access, increasing the ways that patients seek care, and also in addressed in a preventive way, in a wellness way, as we've been talking about, really could have a positive impact on care delivery. What the other piece that our CEO Hal Wolf often reminds us is, you're not necessarily going to see cost savings in the short term, but you are going to see better use of the technology allows for getting in front of an issue sooner, being alerted sooner, so that the patient is addressed, their issues are addressed before it becomes too critical.
I would agree. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Virtual Shift. I'm your host, Tom Foley, and I'm talking to Tom Leary, the Senior VP of Government Relations at HIMSS. We're talking about legislative efforts in context of the transforming delivery of care system. So Tom, let's lean in a little bit on that. I think Hal was spot on in his guidance there. We talk about access, and it's obviously that challenge is very much prevalent in the underserved, the rural communities. But the challenge is we can implement all these digital tools, but the new front door to a health system is a smartphone, hypothetically, mm-hmm, or a website, right? I was listening to some other webinars just yesterday, and they were talking about virtual first, right? So the question is, it's no longer an issue about who pays for telehealth. The question might be is, who's paying for these devices, whether they be the access device or the medical device that they may need in order to enhance their state of well, monitor their state of wellness and enhance their path to the same.
It's a real, it's an important topic for us to be discussing as a country. And really, I think other countries are starting to address it as well. You think about the late Senator Ted Stevens. He talked about the need for access to cable, that thought that maybe the government should fund cable so that because of a lot of what was happening is no longer radio based. There were lots of alerts on safety were happening over cable and, you know, television. Right. Take that same concept and bring it into, you know, 10 years later of a lot of the opportunity for prevention and for making and wellness and really just human interaction are based in smartphone. So, and broadband technology. You know, there's still a large portion of this, of particularly rural and underserved communities that do not have access to broadband, which limits their ability to provide that greater access to care. You know, we have often been reminded by some of our members in West Virginia that there is one gynecologist or OBGYN available for 5 counties in the mountainous part of West Virginia. And if it wasn't for broadband, you know, and making sure that broadband gets into the hollers, you know, the small communities, then you limit the access that the individual might have. And then you're asking a potentially pregnant woman to drive through the mountainous areas of West Virginia to get to this one provider, as opposed to the responsibility of, you know, is it a responsibility of a community? Is it a responsibility of the healthcare system to help to pay for smartphones? You know, people, the Obama phones, I think was really a precursor to shone the light on what that would mean for whether it's the homeless communities or, you know, homeless population or, you know, other parts of the underserved communities, making sure that they stay connected, because in the long run, we are all better off if we're focusing on prevention and wellness rather than urgent and emergent system situation.
Yeah, and I think that's the shift. You talked about investments, or you talked about cost and mitigating costs, and so we have this older, aging, sicker population, right? They've contracted a number of chronic conditions. So, you know, 80% of our healthcare is to the over 60 population. So it's going to take a long time for that to be addressed, because it's really the folks that are, entering adulthood now that need, and beyond, prior to that, to develop different habits and behaviors relative to maintaining a state of wellness, because otherwise we're not going to shift from a healthcare-based system to a wellness-based system, right? Yeah. And would you agree with that?
I would say that the curve is long, but it can be shortened by technology. You know, outspoken leaders in communities. It can be by making sure that we have equity, more equity in care delivery. You know, equity is an important topic across society right now. You know, equity in terms of what we've seen with COVID prevention. You know, whether it's the personal protective equipment or access to the tests. You know, the COVID tests early on in the pandemic, and now access to the vaccines, you're seeing the federal government and state governments work more collaboratively on making sure that there's access and targeting the communities that, you know, or the populations, you know, the age and other, you know, age, older populations and more underserved communities to get the vaccine to them because of some of the technology limitations and access limitations. We'll see that curve shorten over the course of the remainder of the winter and into spring at this point, because of putting more resources to those locations and also making sure that that communities have access to the technology. I'd also say that, you know, the elderly population, you know, my mother's 81 years old, and, you know, we FaceTime with, she's wonderful. Thank you. But she uses FaceTime all the time. You know, she's not afraid of Zoom. She's, you know, but she goes to the senior when or she used to, right? I mean, they're not so much now, but the senior citizens group in little town of Wanacue, New Jersey, they were making sure that one of them got an Apple watch and wanted to monitor their defib, the defib app that was on the phone or on the watch. All of a sudden, the whole table had them. And then the rest of the room was starting to get it, but it was, I think, older folks or not, everybody's interested in technology, interested in keeping themselves around, keeping themselves healthy as much as possible. So it's those conversations, it's the infusion of technology that I think we need to be focusing on.
Do you think we need a national strategy? We had the High Tech Act, right? It was the first foray into a national strategy and alignment of getting all healthcare systems to do something very similar, if you will, even though one would argue it was just adopting an EHR, but it did a lot for, and as a matter of fact, we probably wouldn't have been able to respond to the COVID pandemic as we did without having our health records in a digital format. So do you think we need a Health Tech 2 Act to further align the market and the industry towards a reimagined delivery care system?
That's what I anticipate is a big conversation around, you know, President Biden, when he was candidate, Biden was talking about improvements to the Affordable Care Act. His new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Secretary Becerra, as a member of Congress, was focused on, you know, in many ways, on digital health, particularly in minority and underserved communities. He's made it known in his first week since being sworn in that digital healthcare is important to him. And I would expect that what we'll see is a dialogue throughout the spring and summer on what a national strategy, or at least a coordinated strategy, needs to be. First off, we absolutely need a national strategy on patient identification. From a health IT perspective, for 22 years now, we've had this provision in the Appropriations Act that has precluded us from truly having a national strategy on patient identification. The pandemic, the immunizations that are happening, are all shining the light on the need for a national strategy on patient identification. We need a coordinated national approach on the vaccine rollout, which would then feed into public health infrastructure improvements. What we often forget about is the meaningful use program, the high tech provisions focused on the clinical settings and doctor's offices, clinics, hospitals. Public health in a lot of ways was really left out of the conversation. So public health infrastructure improvements are now starting to happen, but it can't be in a silo. It's got to be in coordination with the clinical, the larger clinical setting, and then getting to a national discussion around what does it mean 10 years hence on the national quality strategy. What do we need to be doing to meet those, the goals of the Obama administration, the Trump administration around value-based care? That's the next big piece that I think the nation needs to be talking about.
So we have 2 minutes left here. Sure. And the underpinning of an integrated delivery of care system, in my view, your mother's from New Jersey. I heard I'm from New Jersey. I can go to New York for healthcare, Pennsylvania for healthcare, and locally in New Jersey. So, you know, my data is all over the place, but the only person that really knows me is my payer. So the point there being is my payer, it's very easy to get the billing data to the payer. What role does the payer have in this? And how does the current actions on interoperability affect that in a national data strategy?
So the idea of around MACRA and the Medicare and CHIP Reauthorization Act from a few years ago was intended to bring an alternate payment model, a structure into play, and pushed for and has really tried to foster these alternate payment model structures across the country where there's more coordination and coordinated care between the healthcare providers and the insurance companies. And you're really starting to see those efforts bear fruit. You see where University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has, but they provide care, and that's the, traditionally what they've done. They also have an insurance arm. You know, you have places like Cigna and, you know, Aetna and Humana, all have, and United, all have different, they're in partnership, or they're providing some level of care as well. They're not just the insurance company. So insurance companies absolutely have a part to play. Coordination between the healthcare system and the insurance, the lines are blurring, and it comes down to care coordination. So what we in the health IT space are, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that there's stronger interoperability. There's the health information exchanges are leveraged and well funded, structured, so that you have data become actionable information, and that all the players, the insurance companies, providers, the patient themselves and their caregivers all have just-in-time information to be able to make responsible decisions. And it all starts with interoperability and knowing who the patient is.
Awesome. Tom, we're going to have to stop it there. I appreciate your time and your great insights. HIMSS is doing great work as always, and look forward to engaging you more. I want to thank my guest, Tom Leary, for joining me today. And of course, I want to thank the show's sponsors, AMD Telemedicine, Intel, and HP. HP Engage long lifecycle products provide stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. If you missed part of today's episode, you can tune in again at 11 a.m. or 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time throughout the week. And be sure to check out the program on Healthcare Now Radio. You can connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter, Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Show. Thank you, and have a great day.